arts to be like a really great way to kind of communicate either environmental science or communicate like topics that people are thinking about, but maybe don't have like the language or are scared, right, to talk about it.
Hello and welcome back to the Agents of Change in Environmental Justice podcast, a partnership between Environmental Health News and Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. I'm your host, Brian Binkowski, editor of Agents of Change and senior editor at Environmental Health News. Welcome back to all of our regular listeners and welcome to anybody new. We are here every 2 weeks talking to up-and-coming and established leaders in environmental justice. Please find us wherever you get your podcasts and please subscribe. Well, I am so excited for today's episode. Last month, our leadership team traveled to Philly and we met our fifth cohort fellows. And today we have our very first guest from this latest round of environmental justice rock stars that we are working with. Today's guest is Dr. Greer Hamilton, a transitional postdoctoral fellow and incoming assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Social Work. Greer is doing fascinating work. She talks about how she got into social work, tips on meaningfully engaging communities in your research, what it means to be an arts-based researcher, and what changes she would like to see in the field of social work. And just a quick warning that we nerd out on Detroit a little bit here and there, but I'm sure you're all used to me doing that every time we have a Detroit-based guest on. Enjoy. All right, I am super excited to be joined by our very first fellow from this cohort to join me on the podcast, Greer Hamilton. Greer, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. We won't talk about all of the technical difficulties that we had before we connected now. They don't need to know about that. So where are you today?
I'm in Detroit, Michigan.
Detroit, Michigan. As all the listeners know, that is a place very near and dear to my heart. So I'm glad you're down there. In fact, when we met and you told me where you're at down there, I was looking around a little bit and it's not too far from some of my old haunts. So I'm hoping to come visit you sometime. But you, of course, did not grow up in Detroit. You're there now for schooling and such. So you mostly grew up in New York State, from what I understand. So can you tell me a bit about your upbringing and where the interest in the environment and health came into your life?
Yeah, so you're right. I mostly grew up on Long Island in a town called Lynbrook, but I also spent 8 or so years of my childhood living in Alabama, where my mother's family is from. And to be honest, like thinking about environment and health issues really didn't kind of come to the focus until college, when I started taking a lot more interest in like thinking more about like, you know, that saying of like, oh, well, zip codes matter, or like where your zip code is can like be a big proxy for like other things. Like that was kind of like the thing that like made me want to think more about environmental and health issues. And I know I mentioned this at like the retreat, but like one of the things that kind of came full circle to me was about like my town, Valley Stream on Long Island, being a sundown town, and how almost like kind of short-sighted, like that zip code as proxy statement is, because, right, zip codes aren't the things that matter, right? Those other factors, right, like racism or other structural issues are the things that create, right, the zip code mattering. And so, like, when I kind of started making those connections, I began to become more interested in, like, how does, like, a public park, or, like, how do neighborhoods, right, factor into, like, our conversations about environment and health, and what do they do, you know, in terms of people's well-being?
Can you explain to listeners what a sundown town is?
Yeah, they were pretty prevalent between like 1940 and 1960 throughout the country. I know like we talk poorly about the South, but like they were in northern places like New York. They were towns that were predominantly white. And after sundown, they were locations where non-white people were meant to not be. And sometimes they were murdered, right, for being in the town after sundown, or they were chased out. But they're just like really like harmful relics, right, of that time period.
You say relics, but man, if you think about the, you know, the 40s to the 60s, I mean, that was long ago, but it's not that long ago. I mean, that's grandparents and stuff, you know, that were around then. So that is, you know, and being in Detroit there, I often think of the zip code that always gets thrown out is 48217. I have it memorized because that is Southwest Detroit. And they deal with some of the worst air in the city and in the state and in the country. So there's been a lot written and talked about not too far from you right there, a zip code that is really determinant of people's health. So you went on to get a dual bachelor's and master's degree at the University of Buffalo. So what was it about social work as a career that spoke to you?
Yeah, to be honest, my parents went through a divorce in high school, and I went to a social worker and was at the time like thinking about going into pre-med. I always kind of planned to be a medical doctor, but at that time in my life, could not imagine also doing that. And I was talking to my social worker about like her job and like what were those opportunities, and she thought social work could be a good option for me because it was still helping, right? And it's also a really broad profession, right? So I could still, you know, be interested in health and make a career out of that. And so that's kind of what pushed me into social work and found it, and then like really developed like a love and appreciation for it.
That is so cool to you know, in pursuing support for yourself, you not only found support but a career and mm-hmm. a passion. That is really cool, and turned something that was maybe difficult into, you know, something that is very positive now. So very cool. I've been asking everybody this: what is a moment or event that has shaped your identity up to this point? I know that's big and unwieldy.
Yeah, I was thinking about this, and I think in my master's program, one that sticks out to me was I worked in a student-run health clinic on the east side of Buffalo, which is a predominantly Black part of the city. And in that experience, it was really interesting because, right, I had to reflect on my Blackness, right, and like about also my privileges, because I grew up middle class, and we were working with people who were uninsured and low income, and you know, they saw me as like a similar person to them. And also there were things that, right, like I didn't share in terms of like lived experience. But also it like made me really want to like pursue, right, research, right, related to health. And so I think about that time, it was like, you know, about a year of working every Wednesday night in this clinic, but it was really cool to work with like medical doctors and community members to like try to figure out ways to improve their health and well-being.
So this leads me really nicely in my next question. So before you returned to get your PhD, which is where you're at now, you were, you know, working in social work in Buffalo. And I know this was meaningful, obviously, to you. Mm-hmm. But can you talk about why you wanted to get your PhD, why research spoke to you as something that you could maybe do more good or, you know, additional good in this space?
Yeah. After my master's, I went on to work at a nonprofit that was focused on actually increasing representation of non-white and low-income people in health professions, including social work and medicine. And then after that, did some work with a local foundation doing community capacity building work with nonprofits. And in both of those experiences, both program managing a nonprofit and working with other nonprofits, I realized how there was like this weird cyclical kind of nature of like funding and research, where nonprofits needed funding, funders wanted research or evaluation, but those nonprofits didn't have either the staff person or the money, right, to then go out and do research or evaluation. And so then it ended up putting large organizations that had that type of resource ahead, right, and then smaller, more grassroots organizations behind. And so I was like, oh, well, I like research. Well, maybe this is something I could pursue and then eventually come back, whether it's to Buffalo or somewhere else, and be that person who can provide that type of research or evaluation support to organizations so that they can do more, right? And get the funding they need in order to do the great work that they were doing.
So you went from one Rust Belt city to another, and we talked about our love of Rust Belt cities, and I have a soft spot in my heart for Buffalo. I used to really like the Buffalo Bills football team when I was a little kid. And now, you know, of course the Lions, because that's where I'm from, but it's just really cool to be working in those cities. I just find them fascinating, the kind of industrial history and all of that. And you mentioned something there that I want to just talk to you a little bit about, and that's representation in healthcare settings, kind of having non-white representation. Can you talk about maybe an example or just why that's important, what that means to people to go into, you know, what can be kind of a vulnerable setting and see people like them, or at least see people that represent their community?
Yeah. I think like it also, I think, ties back to this, my interest in like history and its relationship to health, because I think, right, so much of like the current conversations about Black people and healthcare settings are about how medical doctors often don't like consider them capable of pain, right? And like that has kind of shown up in maternal mortality related situations recently, and how all of those things are like so directly tied back to our history of enslavement in this country. And so I think when people, and I can speak for myself, when I am able to find a Black doctor who is truly able to kind of understand that history, but also to be like the one to ask more questions, right? And not assume that like, because I have a PhD or because of certain things that like maybe I'm not capable of experiencing certain issues, the person like to ask those questions just really matters. And so I think it's sometimes helpful to have a person who is like you in some way, being your care provider or kind of being another person in your life.
So you've been doing a lot of your research is fascinating, and the way you put your research out is fascinating. When I read your application, I think it's okay for me to admit that you were the one that I was telling the staff, like, no, we need her. She's part of this cohort. I was really excited because you're doing a lot of cool stuff, and I want to get into that. But let's start first, kind of take a step back and talk about the research that you're doing. So, and you're also, again, into unique ways of communicating it. So can you tell me about the research you're co-leading looking at indoor air pollution in affordable housing and transportation pollution in the Boston area? What are you all doing and what have you found so far?
Yeah, so our affordable housing project wrapped up last year. It was called Sustainable Air Quality and Affordable Housing. And it was with engineering researchers at Tufts University. And I worked with them over the past 4 or 5 years. And then collectively, those engineers, Nilakshi Hutta and John Durant and I, applied for a grant with this group called Mystic River Watershed Association. And we have now a community-based air quality study in East Boston, Charlestown, Everett, and Malden to monitor the air quality over 3 years, and then to also work with residents to understand their own understandings of air quality and how it's affected them. We chose those four communities because they are communities that are most overburdened by air pollution because of where the highways are, the airport. And also they have the most, or like they have a large population of non-white and linguistically isolated people. And so they're often not represented in this type of research, but it should be, right? And so I think that's what we're trying to kind of do in our work. It's a community engaged study that goes through 2026, and I hope to do all the community engaged research, which is, you know, exciting and fun.
Yeah. Before we get into some of that outreach, have there been, do you have findings yet? Have you looked at kind of air quality and seen, you know, bad things in the air compared to other neighborhoods and stuff? Are there any findings out yet?
Not from our project, but like Boston has done a lot of air quality research over the past 10 years or so. So there is some research, like, I always forget the acronym, but or like the full name, but it's called CAFE. There was a study done in Chinatown, right, where they found that people living in Chinatown, right, were greatly affected by air quality, and also then didn't have like the resources to monitor or to do some of the mitigation strategies. So Chinatown has been doing a lot of research in those years following. For our project, we started last April, so we have some preliminary survey data. That finds that like a lot of people are concerned about air pollution, but either don't understand what are the sources of pollutants, or right, don't understand what to do to make improvements, right? Whether that is personal behavior changes or advocacy work. And so that's kind of what we're hoping to do next.
We just did a big investigation, our newsroom with the Texas Tribune, looking at air quality in certain neighborhoods, certain Latino neighborhoods. And one of the things that we found was that even when there is data, it's not, first of all, it was often not in Spanish, and a lot of these are Spanish-speaking communities. And then you go to these websites, and I've been a reporter for a while and use the TRI from the EPA and stuff, and it's just a mess. I mean, you almost need a PhD to understand the data in the first place. So I think I really want to get at this kind of community engagement, and that's where a lot of your work comes in. So let's take this study as a way to understand that. Can you talk about your role in getting community members involved in the project and making sure that they're engaged and aware of what you guys are finding and doing?
Yeah. So the first kind of part of like our community engagement efforts were to develop a community advisory board. This is an 11-person board that is made up of young people under 18 and adults who live in those four communities. They are people who are not researchers. They are moms. They are nurses. They are students, right? And we really wanted to prioritize people who lived there and had lived there for a long time in order to kind of like contextualize the research that we're doing. We meet with them quarterly, and they give us guidance on kind of all facets of our work. We also have a community survey that is out in all four communities where we're asking people about what is air quality to them? How do they know, right, that poor air quality is occurring in their neighborhood? Is it smelly? Does it like look bad? And we're kind of the sites that they would want us to do follow-up research in. And then we've also, like back to the like, language conversation you were just having, have been really like intentional about making sure that our work is able to reach communities that we want. So we translate all of our work, whether that's the surveys to materials for like community meetings, into 7 different languages, including English, with the ones that are most represented by those 4. So like Arabic, Haitian Creole, Spanish, Portuguese, for example. And then we've also really been trying to like build out like educational and like kind of workshop series for both our community advisory board members, but also residents. So we've been working with organizations to host like air quality one-on-one workshops so they can like start learning how to deconstruct, right, the air quality data that we might be producing, and also to like do like DIY kind of like air filtration types of projects. And then we're also beginning to offer policy and advocacy trainings over the summer so that our community advisory board members can then take that information back to their community and really start to like work with other organizations around like what are those strategies we want to implement, knowing that policymakers, right, have a lot of responsibility for regulating, right, air pollution, whether it's like idling buses or a truck, right, that's stuck on the 93, right? And so really trying to work with residents around that. So those are some of the ways that we're thinking about community engagement.
That's really great, because I mean it takes everything from okay, let's find out what's in the air, all the way through to okay, now you are armed with this information, here we're going to train you to advocate for yourself. And I think making that holistic connection like that is, it's really exciting. It's really cool to hear about that. So what are some tips you would have for other researchers who are trying to do this kind of community engagement but are having trouble or finding people reluctant or busy? That's probably a big one too. What are some tips you might have?
I think you have to know that it's going to be slow from the very beginning. I work with people who want to do community engaged research but don't want to invest the time. And you can't do this work without investing time. Time not only in like learning what people's needs are, right? Like let's say that like air pollution actually wasn't the top need for people. Like that means that we might have to shift, right? Like kind of our priorities until we can get there. It means like showing up to events that like you don't think are relevant to your work, right? Like a block party or, you know, an event that's happening in a local college. And also listening. I think like my goal always is to do more listening than I am talking. So if a resident is telling me like something that matters to them or something that like I've done that maybe was not in line of how they think it should be done, my job is not to like talk down to them, right? Because I'm in a certain position, and to like really listen and hear kind of what are the concerns that they're bringing up so that I can either shift what I'm doing or shift my thinking or approach around something.
And so you call yourself an arts-based researcher, which is, I love that title. I think it's really cool. And so can you give some examples of the ways that you've used arts to engage with communities around environmental justice research and issues? And what are some artistic outlets or methods that you haven't used yet, but that you'd like to try?
Yeah. So beginning of my PhD, I worked with students in the School of Arts to work on puppetry. So we made some stop motion work about green gentrification, which was kind of the environmental work that I was working on at that time. And it was really cool because it was a really like disarming way of like talking about gentrification, which can be such a heavy topic. And people like we're able to kind of see like the horrors, right, of like what happens when neighborhoods change without people being able to participate in it. And then that shifted to my dissertation where I began to include more like visual arts and storytelling. So like doing like oral history collections and like walking tours as a way to kind of engage people like in their total bodies around these topics. And then now I have a small project that's working on a comic book and an animated film about transportation-related air pollution that we hope to kind of build out to like lead into like some curriculum for like K through 12 people in particular, but as a way to kind of start getting people to be aware of terms, be aware of like air pollution and how it can like affect them, and even lead to like premature death, right? We want people to be more aware of like the health pieces. And, you know, I think we've talked about this, or I know we've talked about this, but like also have a interest in like soundscapes and would love to like think about how could we use soundscapes related to like traffic maybe, or just like the nature with electronic music or either like classic music, classical music. So that's like a, hopefully within the next year I can move into that. But those are some things I'm working on, but find arts to be like a really great way to kind of communicate either environmental science or communicate like topics that people are thinking about, but maybe don't have like the language or are scared, right, to talk about it.
There's also, I mean, we always hear growing up, or at least most of us did, that we all kind of learn differently. You know, some of us like to touch and get into stuff. Some of us like to read or watch, you know, a YouTube video, whatever it is. And the, you know, the soundscapes, the one you mentioned, I am just very sensitive to audio. It really kind of resonates with me. It really, and the kind of stuff that you're talking about, I actually, you know, I do some of that, like, you know, we talked about that. So I do think it's a really good way to kind of spread the message around in all of these different ways, and who knows what's going to stick, right? Mm-hmm. Who knows what, how people learn and stuff. Where does that come from? Were you always, are the arts and kind of being creative something that was prior to research, or did it kind of dovetail with some of this research that you're doing?
It was prior to research. I like had a phase in like high school where I thought maybe I'll be a documentary filmmaker. And I took classes at NYU. They have a really great film school. And so I was like, maybe this will be what I will do. That did not obviously end up being what I'm doing, but it is a full circle thing to come back to the arts now and include in research.
And do you find that, you know, I don't know so much about your advisors or mm-hmm. how that works, but, you know, I know just kind of historically academia and stuff hasn't put a lot of, you know, it's like publish in the journal and move on with your life kind of thing. Do you find that you're finding support and that people are maybe kind of changing in that regard and open to kind of some of these different methods?
I do. I do think that the people are open and becoming more open to arts. And that's why I ended up at University of Michigan. So they actually put out a call for arts-based research position last year when I was on the job market. And that was what drew me. I was like, oh, how cool it is to see a school like Michigan be interested, right, in arts work. I will also say that there are evolving flaws, right? Like they're like, right, because people have for so long thought of like research as like one thing and publishing as the only kind of output, right? Like they are having to change kind of their own metrics to figure out how my work fits into that. But I will say they've been really supportive of like, and encouraging of me using the arts in my research. So I hope that more schools will do that.
And, you know, I have a brother-in-law, just as an example here, who wasn't really environmentally engaged. He's a tribal police officer up here. And he watched a documentary about, I believe it was about dairy, you know, dairy cow. I don't know what the documentary was about. He quit eating dairy, like immediately. That was it. Like no more for him after he saw, I don't know if it was animal abuse, you know, some kind of animal rights issue. He's done. That was it. Wow. And it just spoke to me that like, oh gosh, you can put all of the articles out in the world and you can write all of the stories and send all of the tweets. But if you can find that kind of storytelling aspect, in this case, it was a really well done documentary, I assume. I mean, it had a profound impact on his life. So I'm just such a fan of this, and I'm really excited to see where you take some of this stuff. So very cool. Another avenue that you're interested in, I know you have some different activist tendencies and things that you're very interested in. And I know reproductive justice is something that you're interested in, have engaged in, and it opened your eyes to the intersection of colonialism, capitalism, and environmental injustice, of course. So can you talk about your work in this space and how it shows these issues as interconnected?
Yeah. When I was in my master's program, that was actually my first research experience. I did abortion access research with a professor. And this is before Roe versus Wade was ended. And I learned like how profoundly like geographic location informs people's access to abortion, right? So like people having to travel really long like distances in order to get an abortion, or like the wait times at the time. And I think for me, it really reinforced like the role of place in terms of health and environmental issues, that these are also the same communities that are likely to be overburdened or experience overburden by environmental toxins. And these are also the same people who are less likely to be able to access like a basic healthcare need like an abortion. And I think it also was a good reminder that things like Roe versus Wade, which we, you know, I think for a long time people kind of claimed was the ultimate dream of abortion rights, actually had its flaws, like that people were not getting the care they needed. And so, you know, now that, you know, Roe versus Wade has been overturned, it's been even more kind of painful to see the ways that like geography informs people's or restricts people's right access to abortions, and how those geographical barriers are deeply tied right back to like colonialism and capitalism and racism, right? That those things were created intentionally, right, for people to not be able to access services that they need, whether it's like in their local area or within a larger state. And so I'm hoping for more people to like learn more about those barriers that people face, because it's not as easy as people think to get an abortion, even in 2024, and even with like medical or abortion pills being readily available, right? Those pills are also sometimes constrained, right, by location. So yeah, it's a issue that's really near and dear to my heart. And I'm glad to have seen over the past couple of years people learn more about abortion restrictions in the country and reproductive justice.
And it's another one of those really frustrating issues. And I should say, as we speak right now, you know, Arizona just turned back the clock this week in such a archaic way on this very issue,
and you know, Florida.
Florida, right? And it's one of those things. It's kind of like gun rights, where it's so frustrating that when you actually look at the electorate, you know, it's not really that controversial of an issue. Mm-hmm. There really is kind of mostly broad support for this, and to see how our, you know, the system has been perverted in a way that allows people to make decisions for others is really something. But I think you're right. You have seen kind of a groundswell of awareness, if nothing else, after Roe fell. So I guess we will see what happens. Do you still, is this work that you still engage in now that you're in Detroit and in Michigan, or are you too busy?
No. So I've been on the board of boards of abortion funds for the past couple of years, first with Eastern Massachusetts Abortion Fund. But now that I'm in Detroit, I'm with the Midwest Access Coalition, which is a practical support fund, actually, which people may not know about. But practical support is tends to be hotels, airfare, childcare, you know, food support, like the other things, right, that people require in order to access an abortion. And so I'm really proud of the work that Midwest Access Coalition does, and I'm just proud to be a board member. And also, I will just put a plug, it is Fundathon season. It is the peer-to-peer fundraising campaign for abortion funds across the country and some international ones. But if you go to NN, like Nancy, AF.org, you will find, or you should be able to find, your local abortion fund. And they likely are having some sort of event or fundraising effort for the next month or so. So great time to give, because people's money are drying up now that people have decided that the Dobbs decision no longer takes precedent.
Thank you so much for that. It is a great time for people to get involved in this, especially, you know, as we head into another election season and this is top of mind. Hopefully everybody can check that out. So when it comes to social work writ large here, what would you like to see change? I mean, I get the sense that you want to do things a little bit differently than have been done historically. So what would you like to see the field change, and how do you see yourself as part of that change?
Yeah, as much as I love social work, I find it to be a pretty ahistoric profession. I think it often forgets like context matters in terms of like the social issues that we're working on. And so for me, I really try to include history as much as I can in my work. And so would love to see more social workers like integrating and interrogating our history and its relationship to other things. But also I think we're sometimes reactionary in terms of our engagement with social action. Sometimes is right, like other people who start doing social actions, and then social work is like, oh, hey, actually, we should care about it. Environmental issues, I think, being an example of this. And so would love to see more social workers just like less scared, right, of what other social work professionals, right, are thinking counts as social work, and to be more open, right, to like what social work can be and the issues that we should be focused on, and to like take that risk of just being more vocal and more active in issues and issues that matter to you, but also to your community.
I spoke to, I'm forgetting the fellow right now, but she was a city, into kind of city planning, and had a very mm-hmm. similar response that there's a tendency to want to stick within the what the professional parameters have always been instead of kind of integrating yourself in the community. Yeah. And I think there's definitely some lessons there. So this has been a largely positive conversation, but I know environmental injustice is not positive all the time, even though we're seeing some progress. So what are you optimistic about?
I am really proud of the students that are organizing at University of Michigan, where I'm at. There's been a lot of like attempt to like stop them from organizing, but they're making really crucial connections, right, to militarization and militarization and how it relates to like environmental issues or public health issues. And I'm just like always deeply proud of young adults, right, who are willing to kind of take risk, even when there are like potential harms, not only to like their physical body, but also to their ability to graduate. And so I think that makes me really optimistic.
Excellent. Well, now we get to do some of the fun stuff before we get you mm-hmm. out of here. So I have three rapid fire questions, and you can just give me one word or a phrase. My favorite hangout in Detroit is?
Kitab Coffee.
Oh, tell me about it. Where is it at?
they have one in Hamtramck, but they also just built one in Midtown. It's an Arab-owned coffee shop that just is doing really cool community-based work and also has really good coffee.
So I think I've seen the one in Hamtramck. Is it wood paneled? Do you know?
Yes.
Is the
out- okay. It looks the same thing in Midtown too. It's just in Midtown. So.
Okay. So we're getting way in the weeds here, and you can tune out listeners for a second, but I've seen the one in Hamtramck because it's on my walk when I walk to Cafe 1923, which is my mm-hmm. coffee shop that I go to down there. So I will have to definitely try a new one.
Yes.
If I could have dinner with anyone, and this could be living or past, it would be?
Spike Lee.
Ooh, that's a fun one. Mm-hmm. My go-to comfort musician or album?
Leon LaHavas.
I don't know this one. Tell me about this person.
She's from London. She has like a really beautiful, soulful voice. And she got me through the pandemic, so it's a good
listen. That's high praise. Excellent. Well, I will definitely check her out. I've got two recommendations from this. So Greer, this has been a whole lot of fun. I'm really glad we got to connect. And hanging out with you in Philly was just, it was so much fun. There's never enough time at those retreats with everybody. And my last question before we get you out of here is, what is the last book that you read for fun?
The City of Dispossession by Kyle Mays. You would also really like it. It's about Indigenous and Black history of Detroit. And just a really good read.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to give a short plug for Book Suey is the bookstore in Hamtramck where I try to get all my books, even though I live so far away from there now. But they carry a whole local section, so I'm hoping it's in there next time I'm down there. And Greer, thank you so much for being here today. Thank you so much for your time. And I will talk to you soon.
Yeah, take care.
That's all for this week, folks. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Greer. If you enjoyed this podcast, visit agentsofchangenej.org. And while you're there, click the donate button to support us or sign up for our free monthly newsletter. You can also see Greer and all of our current fellows. You can find us on X and Instagram, and please follow us on Spotify or iTunes, where you can subscribe, give us a rating, and never miss an episode. This podcast was recorded, written, produced, and edited by me with Outreach. scheduling and support from the rest of the team, Dr. Ami Zoda, Dr. Yoshira Ornelas Van Horn, Dr. Vina Singla, Dr. Max Ong, Dr. Lariah Edwards, Summer Ahmad, and Maria Paula Rubiano. Our music is Now Sun by Poddington Bear. Thanks for joining us. We hope to keep these important conversations on diversity and science and health going. Have a great week, folks.